All right. Hello. 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 Welcome to another episode of the Sell by Being Human podcast. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and this is the podcast where we learn from people from all walks of life who sell things through the lens of human connection. I think we can learn human skills from people all around us, and this is the place where I'll bring the very best of those people together. So gang, I am really excited for this person that you're about to hear from today. This is somebody I was telling him before the call. I devour his content on LinkedIn, love his TED Talk. This is a former professional magician. We've had a few others on the call, but this is going to be a different take, I think, that you're going to learn a ton from. He now works with organizations and educators to build connected cultures. His 2015 TED Talk on how to magically connect with anyone has reached over 3.6 million people, kicking off the conversation about human connection that we now hear about every day in popular culture and the media. He has since shared his magic and message with thousands of audiences across 5 continents. Get ready for an interactive journey about the magic of human connection. Please join me in welcoming none other than the Connection Magician, Brian Miller. Welcome, Brian.
It did feel like I was being brought up on stage there for a second. I'm imagining a theater full of applause right now. No, Alex, thanks so much for having me. I'm so curious right away. I'm going to take over your podcast immediately. I'm so curious that you've had multiple magicians. That's incredibly rare to be not the first magician on a podcast. What do you find so interesting about magicians bringing on to talk about this topic?
Yeah. So, you know, we've had Oz Perlman, an awesome.
Oz,
yes.
Great.
We've had an amazing person, illusionist. And it's been a while. So, another illusionist, Adam Wilbur. Amazing.
Adam Wilbur.
Illusion.
And I've yes. known Adam forever.
Yes. Love Adam. It's been a while. Adam, don't kill me if you're listening to this. So he also is a speaker. What fascinates me about this and them and is I think people, you know, I think people have like confused or sometimes misconstrue what magicians are doing. They look at things like, oh, they're tricking audiences or making them believe something else. But I look through. I think like because this is a podcast about people from all walks of life, uncommon ways that people are building influence and connection and, you know, ultimately creating change and selling people. Magicians aren't maybe, you know, yes, you're paying money to go to a show, but the real magic is what I think Adam Wilbur even said to me is when people are like wondering and they get out of reality and they see something that it's not just about the trick. Like I see you in your TED Talk, you threw up a Rubik's Cube. And if I just threw this up and all of a sudden it was connected, you'd think I was a jerk. But if I walk you along a story and connect with you and bring you in to that journey and ask you really great questions, then you're like taken to this other place. So I'm just, yeah. I don't know. I'm kind of, I myself love them, love the shows. They're, you get a feeling. I think that's to just, this is a long-winded answer, but you get a feeling afterwards that almost an instant, like in a, you see it in a few yeah. seconds, you can kind of change someone's total outlook on the world and take them to another place. So they've said yeah. fascinating things, and I think a lot of those skills that magicians are focusing on are things that we can all tap into in a little way. So
it's so interesting that you brought up that point. I think there are a lot of things that magicians bring to the table when it comes to human connection. In fact, there was a book written, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago now, on the neuroscience of magic. A couple of neuroscientists yeah. went off and studied magicians in a lab, basically, for a couple of years. And one of the conclusions that they made in the book was, they said, I think we are just now, as neuroscientists, psychologists, sociologists, I think we are just now discovering things that magicians have known for thousands of years. That, like, there's something about the incredibly bizarre and intimate situations that magicians find themselves in with people that lends itself to learning a lot about how humans interact, how they want to be interacted with, and how to take them to places that they want to go or didn't even know that they wanted to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I was saying, you know, for him, apathy is death. You know, he said to me, it's like, if people aren't talking about my show, if they're not recalling, recounting what I did later, that's like death for him. So he's always thinking about how am I being remembered? Not what I did, but what I did and how I'm remembered are two totally different things. So I know, obviously, as a speaker, yes, you say words. Yes, you're on stage. Yes, you're doing things. But that's not what people are saying. Oh my gosh, this guy came to our company event and he told this story that really hit me and made me think of, or that he got on stage and did this trick and it totally wow, and I was taken to another place, and then he told this story, and when I look at, you know, and the last thing I'll say, folks, when you see, we're going to put a link to this podcast, what I remember is the story that you told, and you told it in a way that kind of gave this huge cliffhanger, and we'll talk about storytelling and some tactics for people, but right away, and I won't give up too much because I want Brian to tell it, but Brian told just a very impactful story about seeing people, and a story about how he approached someone who was blind, and he didn't know it at the time, but just something as simple as, like, you ready to see some magic today, you know, could really change his life, because that person couldn't see magic, but the cliffhanger and what happened as a result of that was truly impactful. That's what I remembered from that 15-minute quick TED talk that you gave.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And that's to the point of a magic show, to the point of a speaking engagement, to the point of any sales conversation you're going to have. Most people will not remember most of the things that you said. All the details will blur. And, you know, there's that famous quote, people won't remember what you said. They'll remember how you made them feel. When people describe a magic show, no different than most interactions they have with any human, they don't say things like, well, first he took out the cards and then I chose a card and then I did this and then I put it back and then he counted to 12 and jumped on his head and then he lit it on fire. They don't do that. They go, this thing happened and I felt like they go right to emotion words right away. Yeah. I felt like a little kid again. It blew my mind. They go right to emotions, and that's where we connect with people. I mean, I've been saying this forever, but one of the most important things I learned as a magician is that tricking people is actually not the most important part of your job. The most important part of your job is connecting with people. And it's because fooling people is easy, but making people enjoy being fooled is hard, right? Mm. Like, there's just nowhere else in life we enjoy being fooled. We don't like it when a contractor fools or deceives us. We don't like it when a friend lies to us. We don't like to feel bamboozled or swindled or conned or taken. But for some reason, we enjoy that experience when magicians do it. And so that's where this all came from for me is, well, what are magicians doing that are actually getting people to feel deeply connected with them despite an antagonistic relationship? I mean, magic is the ultimate antagonistic relationship. I know something you don't know, right? It's a schoolyard taunt come to life. There's no reason we should enjoy that, but we do. And that's what magicians understand, is how to get people there.
Yeah. We'll talk about some ways that we can do that in the podcast. So folks, just for where we're headed to today. But and we'll even talk about, like, he slyly went in there about a conversation before this about how apparently contractors are very good at bamboozling people, maybe more so than the magicians, but
podcast, Alex, can be just us working through your therapy session about your recent contractor woes.
Let's do it. We absolutely could. Just pro tip, if you're getting a contractor, ask questions and bet not to be communicated to. But in any case, and tell me where, like, first, I always like figuring out, like, what really led you to magic first. You know, what did you see? I don't know. Sometimes it was people as a kid. Sometimes, you know, someone taught it to them. I'm curious, like, your road there and where you saw the impact that it can have.
Yeah. Yeah. So where did magic come from in my life? Well, where it came from and how it ended up impacting me are actually two different things. So I happened into magic because my father and my grandfather were magic lovers, magic enthusiasts. Oh, nice. They were just obsessed with magic. Neither of them ever did it professionally, but they were both dedicated amateurs, tons of magic kits and tricks. My dad would come into my class occasionally in like elementary school and do a magic show. When my friends would come over, awesome. You know, when I was really little, when I still had friends before I didn't have friends anymore. When I was little and I had friends and they would come over, he would do magic for us in the kitchen. And I vividly remember we used to travel. I'm from Buffalo, New York originally, and we used to travel back to Long Island for Thanksgiving and Hanukkah around that time every year. And my grandfather and I, the week of Thanksgiving in the U.S., there was a show in the 90s called The Magician's Greatest Magicians, Magician's Greatest Secrets, whatever it was. There was a show where just magicians would perform. For like, you just watch magic performances. Awesome. And it was way before, you know, internet and streaming and all this stuff, right? It was just like, it was on, and then if you missed it, that was it until next year. And so my grandfather and I would sit with our noses pressed up against that 12-inch TV we all used to have in the living room and watch magicians. And then I would go away with him into like a bedroom, and he would help me learn a magic trick or a card trick. And then after Thanksgiving dinner, I would stand up and do the trick for my family, my cousins, my whatever. So like I had this real association with learning magic with my grandfather and with my dad. So it was always a part of my life. But most kids are introduced to magic at some point, and most kids grow up. And I didn't. So it stuck around with me to the point of your question about how did it create the impact that it did. So you will often hear magicians describe the field of magic as like revenge of the bullied, revenge of the nerd. Magic turns out to be this incredibly powerful coping mechanism for kids who feel left out, friendless, voiceless. And believe it or not, I had a debilitating speech anxiety and social anxiety as a kid. I had no friends. I was bullied relentlessly. And it was through learning card tricks, through learning magic tricks, that I was able to find a voice and find my confidence, because I could hide behind the cards or the trick. I didn't have to say really anything. I could just do the trick, execute the mechanics of it, and people would be blown away. They would go, oh my God, that was amazing. Hey, did you guys see this? Hey, come over here. And I became the magic kid. And if you get positive reinforcement for that, suddenly I was invited to the parties. People wanted to hang out, as long as I was happy to be a magic monkey on command. I've always got cards. I've always got a fake thumb. Dance I've always monkey. Got something, yeah. Right? Exactly. But I was thrilled to be that, because yeah, that's awesome. It led people to me. And through the years, through high school, over the course of high school, by doing magic over and over again, I got the positive reinforcement and built my confidence in conversations and in interactions, where eventually I didn't need the tricks anymore. And I just continued to be that confident person. So in a very real way, magic saved my life. I mean, it gave me a life.
Yeah. Well, it seems like at some point, yeah, you had to bring in your own personality. You had to learn communication styles. You, at some point, and I don't know if it was when you were an adult, but I think, you know, I sense that at some point you kind of saw the connection between magic and teaching people to connect with others, and that this isn't just a necessarily entertainment thing, which it is. Magic is super entertaining, and that's your lane. I'm sure you still love to do it, but you saw this other lane that, mm-hmm. you know, that could bring out your purpose and actually, teaching people, you know, kind of like some of the, I'll say tactics of magicians in their mm-hmm. daily lives. Where did that shift? Where do you think, you know, that happened, where you said, you know what, this is there's something here to pursue?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Actually, it was an accident, like most things in my career. It was not intentional at all. Back in 2015, I, at that point, had been a relatively successful magician for about a decade. I had gone from local backyard barbecues and local restaurants to touring the country. Made it out of the starving artist life, just awesome. Barely, but then, you know, kind of became as successful as you can be as a magician without being famous, right? I was basically at that point. And then I got two invitations to speak about what I had learned as a magician in the exact same month, the exact same year. In June of 2015, I was invited to give a talk at a TEDx conference that was being held by a group of high school students in Connecticut. And this was properly run by 15-year-olds. And if you go back and watch that TED Talk, it looks like it was run by 15-year-olds. It feels like it was run by 15-year-olds. They were really given the opportunity to put on this conference themselves. So I was invited to speak at this TEDx conference. And I was also invited to give the commencement speech for a specialized high school in Connecticut. It was, you know, it's not a boarding school, but a technical high school, whatever it was. It was like a college prep kind of a high school. And they asked me to come give the commencement speech for the graduating seniors and all of their families. And so within the span of a couple of weeks, I delivered two different talks. And to do both of those, I had to do something I'd never done before. I had to talk instead of do a show. So I was like, well, I'm not going to not do any magic. I can't just talk about magic. So I got to include a little bit of magic, but I can't do too much because they're not booking me for a show. So it was the first time I had to figure out the dynamic between how much magic can I do versus how much content do I deliver. Okay. And then also, I had to deliver a lesson or a takeaway for the students at the commencement speech and the potential people who would ever watch this TEDx talk, which I thought would be nobody. The students in front of me were high school students, so both high school audiences. And so those two talks forced me to think about what I had learned as a magician that would be relevant to non-magicians. I'd never done that before. I'd given talks to magicians many times about magic, but never to non-magicians. And so I started thinking, what do magicians have to offer? What do we learn that would be useful to non-magicians? And one of the first things that came up with was perspective taking. It was, how do you take on the perspective of somebody else in order to connect with them? Because like I said earlier, magicians, we have to connect with people first because it's an antagonistic environment, but also we often have to connect with people very quickly. Like most magicians who are working in close-up magic, like I was predominantly a close-up magician, you know, we're hired for a cocktail hour. And maybe there's 400 people and I've got 90 minutes and my job is to get to as many people as I can and show them a magic trick. And so you walk up with the DJ blasting, you can't even hear your own thoughts and people are holding hors d'oeuvres, their hands aren't free and they're in the middle of a conversation and you have to interrupt their conversation as a stranger, connect with them immediately, show them a trick, blow their mind without pissing them off, say goodbye and move to the next group all in the span of about 90 seconds or 2 minutes. And so I also learned how to connect with people very quickly, which goes against what people assume about human connection. People assume it takes a long time and who's got the time? Well, magicians will tell you, doesn't have to take that long. We have to do it and we have to do it fast. So I started sharing those lessons. The commencement speech went so well. I have the footage of it. Looking back, it was a terrible speech, but it was like my first speech. But it went so well because the students flooded me. The parents, more importantly, flooded me afterwards. They were like, I've never heard something so good. This was so amazing. Boy, it really touched us. I'm so glad our kids heard that. It was this huge response. I was like, well, that was different. Like, usually people are like, wow, that was a fun show. But this was like, this really meant something. I'm going to remember this. I'm going to make sure that we talk to our kids about it tonight and talk about the lessons from it. And then I gave the TED Talk. And a few weeks later, it hit YouTube and it went viral. 3 million people saw it. And it was like, okay, clearly the universe is telling me that this message is valuable and I should probably pay attention to that. And so I just, by the accident of the universe saying, we're interested in hearing this, I said, well, what if I pursued it? What if I decided to get good at speaking the way I decided once upon a time to get good at being a magician? And so I went down that path.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's a great, great story. It's like, I heard you say, like, what are the things that I could offer that to non-magicians? You know, a lot of us don't really think that way. Like I've heard people call it the curse of knowledge. We think, like, this is just basic stuff, like about human connection. It's just common sense, right? Like, duh, you're supposed to ask people about them and, you know, duh, you know, but like, you know, you're, a testament to you've started a company, you're, you know, speaking, and people are literally saying, like, there's a difference between, oh, that was like, I learned a few things, or even, you know, the ones that we forget. We go to a conference and we can't even remember the speaker's names. But, you know, difference to where, wow, that really hit me hard, or wow, you really struck a nerve. You know, those emotional, again, to those emotional things that people go to, you know, it's one thing to do it, but then, I think people want to unlock it and show the how behind it. And it's kind of what I'm trying to do with this thing, non-salespeople, right? Before I go into some of that tactical stuff and what you do today, I always ask a signature question. I usually ask it at the front, but I love that you started as a podcaster. I would not nothing else than you throw a question at me. But I always ask people, Brian, like, when I say the term to you, sell something, but sell it by being human, what does that mean for you? And what do you think of when you hear that phrase?
Yeah, when I hear sell by being human, what I think of immediately is the person sitting across from me needs to feel heard, understood, and valued before we talk about anything I have to offer. That's just immediately. Because if they don't feel heard, if they don't feel understood, if they don't feel valued as an individual outside of the transactional nature of the sales conversation we're having, nothing I'm going to say matters. And maybe if I'm great at all the sales techniques and all the closing techniques, I'll get them to buy anyway. But even if I get them to buy, if they haven't felt heard, understood, and valued, they're going to be a crap customer, a crap client. They're going to complain about everything. It might not be right for them. That's not good for either of us anyway. I don't want them in that relationship. So what I'm doing when I hear sell by being human is I'm thinking, how do I make sure that this conversation results in the best possible outcome for both of us? And that has nothing to do with whether they end up paying me at the end of it.
Yeah. I love those three things. Like, you know, you need to be understood. You need to feel valued. You know, you need to, you know, someone needs to be able to understand, okay, like, this person is truly in it for me, regardless of if it results in a sale or not. And I feel like you exude that. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the things you can do. I think, you know, in that talk, you said something that kind of really defines this for me, because you talk about human connection, ways to do that, but you were doing it from a place, and maybe I'm going to say this wrong, so you can tell me, but like, you can say, you basically said something where everyone in the world, you know, is really, we're more alike than not. You know, we're just, you know, we're looking at things from different perspectives, and you made a quote in that, and it's like, we don't, you also, I've heard you talk a little bit about, like, you know, we could be talking about the same things, but our beliefs about it are completely different, and to, you know, ways to get to that. So kind of help me understand a little bit, Brian, about kind of, you know, what you think about, you know, really trying to help someone feel valued, heard, and all of those things. And I know that could be its own podcast, but what are some of the, you know, maybe what do people get wrong the most, commonly that you kind of see?
So that's definitely an easier way to go about this, because the other ones, and kind of in a Pandora's box, we could go forever. What do people get wrong? So in sales in particular, and we're going to use sales in the loosest possible context, because most of the people that I work with in my consulting firm, they're not selling in a traditional sense, but they are selling ideas all the time. They're selling their ideas to donors, to politicians who need to provide funding for conservation efforts, to, you know there's lots of things that people are selling, and ideas are one of the biggest ones. What do people get wrong when they sell? Almost always the thing they get wrong is they start with their thing, that they're just so excited to talk about their unique solution, their product, their service. And it doesn't have to be, again, a product or a service. It can, you know, if you've got a marine biologist who needs to get funding from a part of the government for conservation efforts, they're always excited to tell you about this cool new tech and how it's going to help conservation efforts, without even taking a second to find out if the person they're talking to cares at all about these conservation efforts. It's obvious to them, and it's obvious to probably me and you, why we should protect animals and protect the environment, but it's not necessarily obvious why that's worth doing to a politician or to whoever you're talking to. we get so lost in how exciting and innovative our own ideas are that we completely forget that other people don't inhabit our own minds, right? That like other people have wants and beliefs and worries and concerns that are just as real and vivid as ours, but are probably different. And so the thing that I encourage everybody to do, whether it's interpersonal communication, whether it's sales, whether it's giving a speech, is to figure out as quickly as possible, where is this person coming from, right? Meet people where they're at. What actually matters to them? We talk about psychographics a lot. Psychographics instead of demographics. Psychographics are beliefs, fears, wants, and problems. So what do they believe deeply, right? Beliefs are deep, not, there's lots, people have opinions, those are not beliefs. Opinions can change in a moment's notice. Beliefs are deeply held pre-existing assumptions about the world, how it works or how it should work. A lot of the times when conversations break down, it's because we haven't done the job of understanding what they believe, and we said something that violated one of their deeply held beliefs, and we don't even know. We have no idea that just happened.
They never tell us. Yeah.
They never tell us. And most people, if you said, tell me your beliefs, will not be able to tell you. They can't articulate it. They just have them. And we need to ask questions and listen deeply to hear those things. I'm going to give you a what will sound superficially like a controversial example, but I assure you it's not. So during the pandemic, and we're all, ding, ring the bell, we're talking about the pandemic. All right, so during the pandemic, there was the mask versus anti-mask, and it was brutal, yeah. Right? Now you're in Florida, so it was particularly brutal where you are. Depending on what side you were on, you were probably very enraged.
My family is a masker, but I'm in a neighborhood where they would laugh at us. You know, they were, you know, we totally. Were attacked, you know, for-
Totally. For yeah. And so you get people who were just shouting past each other about the mask anti-mask debate. And if you actually took a second, take a deep breath, and you asked people a few questions, it wasn't long before you discovered that both sides of that debate held their positions for the same reason. If you ask people on the anti-mask side, why are you anti-mask? You would eventually get a version of, to protect my family. And if you ask people who were masked, you would eventually get, to protect my family. Both people believed that they needed to protect their family, but because of their own life experiences, the access to information that they had, who they happened to be following on social media or whatever, they had different opinions about how to get to the ultimate goal of protect their family. Which doesn't mean one side's right, one side's wrong, which doesn't mean everybody's right or everybody's wrong. That's not what this is. It means you can't have a meaningful conversation about it until you both understand the foundation. You have to agree to something. And if at least we can both agree that we're in it to protect our families, now we can have a respectful disagreement. We can debate it for real and not just be shouting past each other. And I would argue that you can make a real connection with someone even if you disagree with them. You do not, connection is not the same thing as agreement.
Connection is the not is not the same thing as agreement. Say more on that. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I think we are now in a place largely, though not exclusively, because of the social media silos and the algorithms that give everybody a very individualized feed. The bubble is a real thing and it's a real problem. I think we are in a place where we are now very unwilling to engage with somebody who disagrees with something that we perceive as a fundamental belief, right? If you're a pro-vaccine person and you meet someone and you find out right away that they're anti-vax, I think most people today, if you're really honest with yourself, you just disengage. You're not even interested in potentially becoming friends with that person. And I think that's a problem, which is not to say anything about either side of that debate. It's not my place. I have my own personal beliefs. The point of this is to say that if we're searching for agreement, we will be disappointed and very lonely very frequently.
Mm, yeah. You know, I agree. You know, you like I have, and we're in a political season, so like
yes,
you know,
we that, are. Like
the one of the biggest things you could talk, you could, you know, kind of throw relationships off a cliff with a new person is bringing up politics, right? So we just don't talk about it, right? Yeah. And that's a little sad, and like we don't we. you know, I see reasons to talk about it. I see reasons totally not to talk about it. But I do think it's not impossible not to connect with people. Because like you said, if at the end of the day, we're, you know, both of our sides are kind of fractured, right? Or we're diametrically opposed. Mm-hmm. We still, like you said, at the end of the day, want to protect our families, want our families to be safe, want our... you know, our health personally to be safe and to, you know, prosper personally. We all want the same things. We want to go about them differently. And you talk about asking different questions. So I'd love to maybe start there. Like, another thing I loved, by the way, that I'm totally stealing from you. You should all steal this from Brian, by the way. So I'm not citing, this is not from Alex. This is citing from Brian. Those of you that travel a lot will undoubtedly see at an airport someone yelling at a, you know, and gave me the idea. I need to have a flight attendant, someone that's manning a ticket counter or, you know, womaning a ticket counter, that person, you know, who is just dealing with so much negativity, right? And so much stress. And like, they have to connect with people because, you know, at the end of the day, they want this. You said that we all want the same thing. So undoubtedly, you're going to see someone yelling, this is messed up. Get me on this flight. The door is closed, right? You know, some, you know, go against the rules and let them on. But 9 times out of 10, that person is not letting you on the plane. Doesn't matter, right? And they're getting berated. And a simple question you say is just ask, are there any, under what circumstances could you open this door? And I'm like, wow, that could open up that person could be just having a bad day and they put it like they closed it at 9 minutes and 30 seconds and they just, cause they could, and they might be like, you know what? Go ahead. Or they may go, I couldn't let my mother on this.
Couldn't,
right?
If I wanted to.
If I wanted to.
Couldn't let my mother on it.
And then right. You're like, you know what? Okay, we're in a different conversation. But then that opens a different, a new conversation to, you know, let's talk about another flight or whatever. As opposed to like, you know, sir, like, you know, I have to call the, you know, police if you're going to do it. Like, I'm going to have to like help someone else. I'm going to like, I have 10 people like you, sir. So I have to help them first, you know? So what are some of these great questions that you could give to some of our listeners to kind of meet people where they are, Brian? Cause I thought that was amazing. I don't know if you have any other examples that you share when you're teaching.
Yeah. It's so funny. I'd forgotten about that example. I used to talk about that one a lot. That one, just because when I was traveling so much, you just saw it so frequently, just people screaming at a gate agent. And you just go, first of all, the odds that they can actually do what you're asking are probably zero. Cause it's not 1990 anymore. Yeah. Like these things are locked down. They're automated. There's no way. But it's like, even selfishly, just be self-interested. Forget all this connection crap we're talking about. Just be self-interested for a second. If this person could help you, do you think screaming in their face is going to get them there? They might not be able to help you, but they can definitely hurt you. They can definitely keep you from getting on the next flight. Yeah. So like, even if you're just going to be self-interested about it, you're making a bad choice. But obviously, if you're going to ask a question that's more open, like under what circumstances would you be able to get me on this flight? If they say no, like you said, now you're having a different conversation, and now they might be able to say, because that's a collaborative question, right? That's let's work together. And so they might be able to say, no, there's nothing I could do to get you on this flight, but, you know, where do you need to be and when? Let me see what I could do, whatever. There are lots of questions that we can use, and a lot of these are questions that I teach people on how to take small talk to something deeper very quickly. Mm-hmm. You've seen a lot of TED Talks and a lot of articles over the last few years that are arguing that small talk is bad. We should be having big talk. I disagree. I think small talk is wonderful. I think it's great because it's a gateway. It's an easy, non-threatening way into a conversation. People are willing to talk about the weather because there's no risk in talking about the weather. Great. Let's use that to start talking. Let's just learn how to transform that small talk into something deeper. Where small talk goes wrong is when we say, hey, it's raining outside. And they're like, it is raining. And you're like, sucks. And they're like, yeah. And that's it. It's over. Like, it doesn't go anywhere.
How's the weather where you're at?
Useless. Where are you from? You know, Boston. Cool. I've never been to Boston. Yeah, that's it. It's over, right? So there's just nothing. So one of my favorite questions is, what do you love about that? And you substitute that for whatever it is. So you say, where are you from? They say, I'm from Boston. You say, well, what do you love about Boston? You instantly get a real conversation because people will immediately go from superficial to they're going to tell you a story. They're going to say, oh, well, you know, what I love about Boston is that, you know, I have kids. And so we get to walk around the city. It's like it feels like a community, even though it's a city. They might say something like that, right? If they say, if somebody complains about the rain or about the weather, they're complaining about the rain. You say, well, what kind of weather do you prefer? And they might say, oh, you know, actually, they might say, it's kind of funny. A lot of people don't like this, but I prefer snow. You go, really? What do you love about the snow? You go, well, when I was a kid, I used to go skiing with my dad. Boom. Real conversation, right?
Yeah.
What you're trying to do is get someone to move from the superficial to giving you something about their values or their beliefs or a story, which often contain values and beliefs, as quickly as possible. And so what do you love about that? Same, you know, you ask a student, you know, what's your major? Have you tried to talk to like an 18-year-old recently? It's brutal, man. I'm at colleges all the time and it's real tough. So what's your major? And they go, marketing. And you go, cool. You know, it just doesn't go anywhere. So you say, well, what do you love about marketing? And they may not even know how to answer that, but they'll find a way to answer that.
Yeah.
They'll go, well, I don't really know that much about it yet. I only took one class about it. You say, well, what's the most interesting thing you've learned in that class so far?
Yeah.
You're just asking them questions to get them talking about something that lights them up.
Emotional questions, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for folks, tell me, like, maybe there's a story around this, but like you had something like four words that changed my life or whatever. Mm. It was just like, I like that hat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is what happens when you don't put your headphones on in public. So this was, you know, the quick version of this story, and there's lots of footage of me telling the full story online, so you can go look it up. But the short of it is I was in a really bad mood at the airport in a time in my life when I wasn't making it as a magician. I'd been trying for a couple of years and I wasn't even barely able to afford to feed myself. And I thought I was going to have to give it up and go back to school and tell my dad he was right. And
oh no,
this is all no, you know, anything to avoid doing that. And I had a couple gigs left to fulfill. So I'm at the airport at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm exhausted and I'm miserable and I'm existentially confused. And I end up on a plane sitting next to this lady. I was in my early 20s at the time. She's maybe in her mid 30s. I'm sitting next to her and the pilot tells us that there's going to be a 45-minute delay. Like my morning's just getting worse and worse because someone forgot to put the wing on or whatever. And then she says to me right before I put my earbuds on, she goes, I like your hat. We hadn't even been having a conversation yet. I was just about to put my headphones on and drown out my morning, but she got that in before I did. And it started a conversation. And we started chatting and we ended up hitting it off. She was a marketing professor at the Yale School of Management, one of the top programs in the world. And she studied magicians. I kid you not. Didn't know I was a magician. Yeah. She studies influence and persuasion and particularly studies magicians. And we hit it off. And eventually she became a close friend and a colleague. And years later, when I had to give a TEDx talk and I panicked because I didn't know how to write a TED talk, I called up my old friend Zoe. I said, can you help me write a TED talk? I know you gave one of these. She helped me write it. Thing went viral, transformed my life, right? And so like, it was the ripple effect that went on for years. We're still in touch. I see her at least a couple times a year, usually. You know,
awesome.
Last year, the year before, when her first big book came out on a major publisher, she asked if I would do a couple of magic tricks at her book launch party, even though I was no longer a magician, and I did.
That's
and
awesome. So, yeah, it's, you know, just the little things. Yeah,
but it was nothing. It was a nothing comment. It was your hat.
Throwaway. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people might think it was a throwaway. So, you know, I really like the ability just to go deeper a little bit onto to belief and people. Sometimes you just, you know, you say something and it totally throws it in the face of someone's total, you know, belief and assumptions about the world, and they will never tell you, right? And you can't even, you know, kind of get that out of them, right? Mm-hmm. So what you do right, you know, today, a lot of your talks, you know, around human connection, storytelling, do you have like, I don't know, something that you think in what you teach that, you know, maybe there's like a certain talk that, you know, is really, well attended or you get a lot of response from. You know, something like specific about like some of the stuff you do today that you think, you know what, that really is resonating with people about really, you know, going back to the beginning, understanding, valuing, that sort of thing. And this could go a lot of places, but I'm sure you probably, I always feel like speakers, they know when they really just knocked it out of the park, right?
You know? Yeah, I mean, a handful of things over the last just 2 years come to mind right away that are getting like the biggest responses. One are you already asked me about, which is some of those kind of easy questions you can ask people to deepen a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, so what do you love about that was one of them. Another one I'll give you real quick, and then I'll give you a different answer to this question. Another question, or not even a question. You ever get that situation where you're genuinely interested in the person that you're talking to, and they've been talking for a little bit, and you can feel that they're wrapping up their side and it's going to be your turn to speak? And you realize that you have no idea what to say. You don't have a follow-up question. Your brain forgets what language you speak. You forget all words and you panic. If that ever happens to you, just say, "Tell me more about that." It is a conversational get out of jail free card. And it feels like a trick, but it's not. When you say, "Tell me more about that," and you say it genuinely, you mean it, what you're doing is you're saying, unlike how we normally have conversations, which is two people desperately vying for attention, trying to one-up each other back and forth, not even listening, right? Most of the time, you can feel the person you're talking to is not listening. You can feel that they're just trying to formulate the next thing they're going to say, or they have an opinion about something you just said, or a joke they want to tell you, or a story, and they are just ignoring you until your lips stop. That's what usually happens, and we can feel it. When you really listen, and they stop talking, you just say, "Well, tell me more about that," or some version of that. They actually, you will see their body, their whole body posture will change. They will sit up straighter. They will perk up, because so rarely in today's world are people given the floor like that, given the spotlight. When you do that, you say, "I actually value what you have to say more than I value me getting my thing in this conversation." Yeah. Tell me more about that is great. Now, to give you a totally different answer, like what's going on in the world when I'm out there speaking that's really interesting lately, it's something I never expected. There's a throwaway chapter in my book on the art and importance of remembering names. It's a throwaway chapter, not because it's not something I care about, but because I was done with the book and my editor was like, "We need like 8 more pages." And I was like, "I don't have anything else. I've been writing this for 2 years. I'm done. I have nothing else." She's like, "I need like 8 more pages. I need like one short chapter." And I was just like, "All right, here's the thing." And I just tossed her a couple of the techniques I use to remember people's names. We threw it in towards the end of the book, assuming nobody would read it. Man, I've been asked about that chapter more than any other chapter in the book. I get asked about it in media interviews when I go on traditional media. And we've now built an entire presentation called The Magic of Networking that largely rests on learning how to remember and use people's names. Because it is so, the corporate world can't get enough of this. So I have a couple of tips if you're interested.
Yeah, real quick. Yeah, we love it. Thank you so much. And
So here it is. I'll save you from having to bring me to your company to say all these things from the stage. So the first one is the one pretty much everybody knows, but nobody does even though they know it, which is to repeat it back after someone tells you their name. So if I say, "What's your name?" and you say, "Alex," and I would go, "Alex, great to meet you, Alex. Alex, let me ask you a question." So what I just did was hit your name 3 times in 8 seconds. Yeah. Now, when I tell people to say the person's name back to them 3 times very quickly, they're like, "That's too many. It's going to sound awkward." I'm like, but it doesn't sound awkward. Not if you do it with the right cadence. So when they give you the name, they say Alex, and you go, "Alex." The first one is confirming that I heard you right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And today, people, you have no idea. People's names can be spelled differently. They can be all kinds of things. So I confirm that I heard it right, Alex. And then I go, "It's great to meet you, Alex," or "It's nice to meet you, Alex." Now I'm actually giving you the response to your name. So I've hit it twice. And then if I'm going to ask you a question, I start with your name. "Alex, let me ask you a question." And then I ask my first question. And it doesn't feel weird to hear. It feels awkward to do if you've never done it before, but not to hear. And if you hit their name 3 times that quickly, there's a very good chance that you will remember it.
Love it.
So that's the first one.
Yeah. Well, we could go a long time. Like I'm going to tease this because like we'll have to put the link for the Brian stuff. I can just speak from experience. Like I've had somebody, you know, at a recent, I've gotten feedback where I was, you know, calling a guy Matt and his name was Matthew, and preferred to be called Matthew. And I didn't find out later until we were having like an exit interview of how we didn't win something. And I'm not saying like, by remembering that. And it was just something I think I was dealing with another Matt and I got it. You know, we have it all the time. If you're dealing with two of the people with the same name that we call, or, you know, even worse, like I've called someone a totally different name because I was just, my brain was fried, but names are so important. So we'll put some links to that stuff. Brian, I want to kind of close with like storytelling because like that's a big part of what I see you do and what you've done on the podcast and what you did in that TEDx talk. You gave just maybe closing with this story. So this was, what did you learn from that story? Maybe you could finish telling that story. And what did you learn from that story that really inspired that TEDx talk that you gave?
The story of the blind guy in the restaurant?
Ed.
Yes. So I always hesitate to tell the story itself on the podcast. This is not a this is not a ploy to get you to watch my TED talk. It's 3.6 million views. I don't need another single view. But essentially, I walked up to this couple in a restaurant when I was a young magician, and I, you know, said, "Would you like to see some magic while you wait for your meals?" And you know, he just looked up towards me and he said, "I would love to see some magic, but I can't. Unfortunately, I'm blind." And I just froze. I looked at them, like really looked at them for the first time, and it was obvious he was blind. It was so obvious. And I realized in that moment that I hadn't even been looking at them at all, that I was completely wrapped up in my own evening. I was lost in my world of being a magician, and I was just excited to, like we talked about with sales, excited to just do my thing. I wanted to get my magic. That was what I was selling, magic tricks, at that table. And it really shook me. I had to take a step back. Eventually, I ended up a few weeks later, they came back in and I was able to create some magic for him that did not involve sight, which was, that helped me reinvent how I even thought about magic. I always saw it as a visual medium and then I realized it wasn't. But that whole experience taught me how powerful it is to make people feel understood, to make people feel heard, to make people feel valued. One of the most important lessons I learned was that it's not enough to care about somebody. Like it's not enough to understand them. They have to feel understood. They have to feel cared about. I think a lot of us, particularly people who actually see themselves as empaths, a lot of empaths think, well, I feel everything, so I must be naturally so good at connecting. It's like, well, I know you feel, but do they know that you care? Do they know that you understand them? And if not, you actually haven't done it because connection happens on their end, not on your end. And so that was a really important lesson.
Yeah. I mean, I always think people confuse like empathy with like you having to feel what someone else feels.
Totally.
As opposed to just understanding and maybe going back to your own experiences and putting yourself into a place of what you've felt. It's not feeling what they've felt. It's maybe understanding, you know, your own experiences of being in the place where they are and, you know, and just believing them, believing what they're telling you they feel, right? And you talk a lot, we talked a lot about perspective taking is maybe even more effective because you're, you know, seeing it, we can, you know, misconstrued, you know, taking someone's point of view or putting yourself into someone's shoes. Yep. I've even used the quote, Brené Brown says, it's not putting yourself into someone's shoes, it's actually seeing the world from their shoes and just believing them, even when those differences differ from your own, you know, it's not trying to put yourself into their feelings or emotions.
And that's the primary reason that I don't talk about empathy. You almost never see the word empathy on any of my work, which is very unusual for someone working in human connection. And the reason is exactly, Alex, what you just said. It's that empathy is an emotional state. It's feeling what someone else is feeling as if it were happening to you. One, I can't teach you how to do that. Basically, no one can teach you how to do that. You either feel those things or you don't feel those things. Right. If you spend a lot of time in therapy, you can learn to be more empathic, but like most of us are not doing that. So, okay, first, I can't teach you how to do it. And second, it's not that useful. In fact, talk to people who are really empathic. It drains them all day, every day. They feel what other people are feeling as if it were happening to them. It's draining. You don't need to do that. Perspective taking is a skill. It's just a skill. And because it's a skill, it's a growth commodity. You can learn it. You can practice it. You can hone it. You can develop it. And as you get better at learning to ask meaningful questions and understand the perspective of the person who is telling them to you, you will naturally become more empathic and you will make meaningful connections with people. That's why I teach it as a skill.
Yeah, I love it. All forms of compassion, forms of empathy and perspective taken, but in just different ways and ways we can learn. As we close off, Brian, I ask people just a fun question about them because I think we all have these unique things about ourselves that can connect us to others and, nice hat, all those things. But like if I asked your wife, people closest to you, people in your family, just something that is just so uniquely Brian. What is just maybe an event that would only happen to Brian? Something that is just so totally Brian. What would they tell me? What's something that is just so totally you?
Oh my goodness, so totally me. That's such a good question. I don't think I've ever been asked that question before.
And it stumped some people. So like this is our brains, like Brian's thinking out because he's probably has so many stories. He's just trying to bring them to light. But yeah.
So I think what's so uniquely me is telling stories. It seems like a letdown of an answer after everything we just talked about, but I mean in my personal life. So I can be accused of burying the lead in my personal life very frequently.
Oh,
because
interesting.
I get so frustrated when, like, let's say, like, something happened to me and my wife, something funny or something terrible or something crazy or whatever, and she goes to tell someone else about it, and she just says, and here's what happened, and she just tells them the end,
exactly.
The punchline.
Yeah.
And I'm just
you
like,
you want to build up.
It's not just that I want to build up. I go, it didn't land. They don't understand why that was bad or why that was great because they don't have the context for what mood we were in, what had happened before that, what we were thinking about that day. There's all these things that people need to understand for the actual thing to mean what it means, to us. And so I can go the other way. I can have a habit of telling an 8-minute story to get ultimately to, and so anyway, the food arrived late. And like, and it's like not worth the story I just told. So I can definitely, like my wife will be like, just tell them the thing.
Tell them what happened.
I'm like, right. No.
I love it. That's hilarious. Yeah. Well, Brian, I've so enjoyed a conversation, man. I could talk to you for hours. Hopefully this isn't the last one. It's just the start of many. Where would people learn more about your work and connect with you in ways that we've been talking about?
Yeah, for sure. Easiest way is go to connectwithanyone.com. And I think you just toss your name and email in there. Great URL, right?
I love it.
connectwithanyone.com. If you toss your name and email in, you'll get the resource is one of our most popular resources, which is 7 ways to talk to anyone without looking like an idiot. So it's a great conversation starters that you will actually use along the lines of things that we've talked about today. And then you'll immediately get access to my blog, which you've referenced many times in this conversation. And then you can find me on all the socials and LinkedIn from there. But connectwithanyone.com.
Awesome. Brian Miller, you've been a joy, my friend. Thank you so much for hopping on podcast today and the conversation.
Alex, thanks for having me. Let's do part 2.
Yeah, I love it. Done.
Hey gang, this is Alex. Thank you so much for making it to the end. If you heard a quote you liked or got a little bit of value, drop me a line or a comment. It means the world to me. We have great human beings throughout all walks of life every single week who sell through the lens of human connection. And I'll see you on the next episode of Sell by Being Human. Thank you.